Well, Donna, you're probably wondering how I became a regent. I have never taken an active part in politics, although my brother has been active. My brother ran for United States Senate, and he ran once for the governorship. But I have supported politics financially and in other ways, but not as an actual candidate. I have always had a great interest in the university, because both Martha and I were graduated from there, and I think, and I've always said that if I've accomplished anything in life and the world, I owe it to my university education, because it stimulated me. It opened avenues for me that I couldn't have had open had I not gone to the university.
Let me just ask one thing at this point. Was there ever any question in your mind as you were growing up that you would go to the university or that you wouldn't?
No, there was not, Donna. I can remember my mother, and my mother didn't have only a nominal education, but she almost insisted that I go to university. And I wanted to go, and I was an average student in high school, and I can remember mother saying to me, when you go to the university, don't you dare come back, because our school had a very poor reputation, our high school. Even the year before, the valedictorian, salutatorian flunked out at the university. In fact, I lived with a salutatorian, he flunked out. And so mother said, don't you dare come back. So I really buckled down and studied real hard and got through in fine shape and met some great people over there. One I can think of today, you know him, Dr. Gus Boston.
Oh, yes.
He's 90 years of age, and I see him, that gentleman. He was on the crew as a student. I admire that man because of his mental faculties at this 90 years of age. And another side light, you know, a few years ago he had a mission in South America, and you know, at his age he studied, went and took a semester in Spanish so he could talk, speak the language. Well, those are the kind of people at the university that were there. There was Dr. Morrison there, and of course E.B. Fred, and oh, there's so many. Mortimer, he's dead now, and the Granami, those people, they were great. So, no, I never had any feeling that I didn't want to go to university. I felt it was important to go, and I had parents that stimulated me. And my mother had almost forced me. So.
And you didn't come back.
I didn't come back. And fortunately, not after I graduated from the university, my mother died. I think that's one of the great regrets of my life. She never saw these youngsters, these little grandchildren. That always means so much to grandmother. Well, things went along, and of course I was busy working here in the company, and not particularly interested in politics, Donna. I was interested in who would get elected and probably give some financial support. But, and I didn't know Governor Knowles very intimately. Wilbur knew him much better than I did. I was playing, we were playing bridge. Martha and I was Wilbur and his wife. A telephone call came from Governor Knowles to Wilbur. He said, is Walter there? I'd like to talk to Walter. And I talked to Governor Knowles, and I did not even know that there was an opening for a regent. There was a vacancy.
You hadn't paid that much attention.
I wasn't much interested in that. Mm-hmm. Although Wilbur had been a regent previous.
Yes, I know.
And he said to me, could you be in my office tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock? I said, yes, I could. What's the urgency? Well, I said, I want to talk to you about being a regent. And I talked to Martha, and I went over at 9 o'clock. Or he said, either at 9 o'clock or meet me at the airport. I got to catch the plane at 11. I said, I'll be at your office at 9. He said, I want to appoint you to be a regent at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. That's 9 years. Well, I said, Governor, I'd like to talk to Martha, because usually in any important decisions, we don't make them without consulting each other. And that was quite a step. So I went home, and Martha says, sure, you take that position, so I became a regent. And not that I was any very active in politics, Donna. I never went out and stumped the state for any particular candidate and things like that. I went to a few meetings. That's the extent of it.
But you did care about the university.
I did care about the university, and I still care about the university. In fact, I watch every decision that the regents make, and the big protest they just had now, and I went through that.
Well, you became a regent, of course, in a rather troubled time.
I became a regent right at the start of the riots. I became a regent in I guess it was 1st of May, and right in the middle of May is the first incident when the, I think 17 students took over Robert Fleming, who was chancellor of office, just took it over, and he came in and forced him out. And I was on the campus at the first big riot when they had the Dow Chemical was interviewing students, and they were going to...
Well, that was just, that was sometime in 1967, if I
That was the first big riot. And how I got onto the campus, I'm a member of the Madison Rotary Club, and Dean, what's his name at that time, I can't think of his name, he was a member, and some of the other faculty members said their students are congregating out, taking over the Commerce Building. Well, I said, I'd like to go out there with you. I'd like to see what's going on. Well, they said, you can't get to the campus driving the car. It's all blocked. Well, I said, can I ride out with you and walk? Which I did. Well, Donna, have you ever been to a riot?
I was on the campus during this period, yeah. And not involved in it. I was working in an office in Van Nuys, looked down on it.
Well,
on some of the activity.
It's a frightful thing. People lose all sense of responsibility. I know, of course, they had this group there from San Francisco at that time. I forgot what they called it. All painted up, you know, they were the leaders of this riot. They took on the building and they were ordered through a bullhorn to vacate the building. They didn't get out until the police began to carry them out.
Now you were just standing in the crowd?
I was standing outside with the crowd. Watching. And they would kick and they'd bite and they'd scratch and they'd swear. It's terrible. Finally they used tear gas. I got some tear gas. And then I went over to the chancellor's office, and the chancellor at that time was, let me stop that a minute, I think. Bill Sewell had just been appointed chancellor, and I went to his office, and of course Bill was all upset, and I didn't bother him very much. And finally the crowd dispersed, and I walked uptown, the only way I could get back, and I went right directly to the chief of police, Bill Henry's office. Well, of course, they were all out, there was nobody there, so nothing I could do, I went home. I was very disappointed following that riot, Donna, because the faculty met at the union. And of course they had, some of the rioters were still outside, were offering slogans and slurs at them as they walked in. Well, Bill Sewell was up there alone. Now, I was very disappointed that President Harrington stood down there and never once got up and defended Bill Sewell. He sat there and let Bill Sewell take all the brunt of that riot. Some of the faculty were in sympathy. The majority were not. Then they had a second meeting, faculty meeting. That time, Fred Harrington did get up and defend Bill Sewell. After all, Bill Sewell was his man. He's the man that he recommended for the job.
Well, Fleming, course, I guess, had left at this point.
Pardon?
Fleming had left the campus.
Yes, I guess I should mention that in retrospect. Bill Fleming was appointed and elected president of the University of Michigan from that job. And incidentally, I never could quite understand why Bill Fleming did this, but after these people took over his office, 70 of them were arrested, he put up bail for the same people that took over his office.
I remember that incident.
And the laughable part of it is, I know up until 2 years ago, I talked with George Young, who at that time was dean of the law school, or just relinquished the deanship, and Fleming wrote or called George Young to see if he could recover some of his bail. He hadn't recovered all of his bail because some of these youngsters just flew the coop. Let Bill Fleming hold the bag, which I think should have taught him a lesson. I cannot see an executive or administrator putting up bail for people that are trying to disrupt his part of the organization. That I could not see, but he did put up bail for him. But anyway, it didn't affect Bill Fleming or Robin Fleming because he got to be president of the University of Michigan. Incidentally, he also could have been president of the University of Minnesota.
How could he?
There's a little incident to that. I think I'll relate that if I tape this.
Yes, please.
At the time of the presidencies of Michigan and Minnesota, they both needed presidents. Robin Fleming was considered for both. And one of the regents at the University of Minnesota was at a cocktail party. And he imbibed a little feeling, he got a little talkative. And he says, "We have just offered the presidency of the University of Minnesota to Robin Fleming, the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin. In the meantime, Robin Fleming had accepted the presidency of the University of Michigan." So this got out in the papers in Minnesota. Robin Fleming, new president, here he had accepted. So their face was red. Here this fellow talked out of turn, which is why they say you've got to have open meetings. I tell you, when you do that sort of thing, it's got to be secret. So they were there without a president. So they went to the next person, who at that time was president of the University of Kansas. They said, "Now we're going to offer you the presidency of the University of Minnesota." He says, "If it wasn't good enough for Robin Fleming, it isn't good enough for me." And they had to start all over. That's when they brought Moose in. And Moose was fired, I guess it was a year or 2 years ago. So that's the story, an interesting story. And it's interesting because it just shows that when you come to such important decisions, it's got to be quiet. I don't see how you could ever have that right out. I think some of these students wanted right out and open with all the reporters there. That's my thinking on that.
Well, they more or less got it that way recently with the chancellor of Madison
campus.
Yeah,
well, of course, the one that they had the student member of that board, this present board, leaked that information.
Yeah,
everybody knew there was two or three men.
Well, the meeting was hardly over before
it
was published in the paper.
That's right. And of course, what it does, these are men that are of high stature in their profession, and they may be considered for a position some other place. And if I sat here like the fellow down at Kansas and said, "Well, it was good for him, I'm not interested in it either." Or the school might say, "Well, Wisconsin didn't take him, we don't want him." It's reversed, see? That happened in that case. Well then, of course, riots did not end on the campus.
Not that year.
No, they continued for a couple, 3 years. In fact, I guess President Mayor Madison was arrested a couple times for rioting.
You're speaking of Paul Sagan.
One incident that particularly affected me, Donna, was this was during semesters. They had this program, this Black Power for something, where they featured the black students. And they brought a lot of blacks in from the West Coast. And they had their programs in the union. I cannot think of the man's name. I probably have it here, and I've got it written up. I can maybe give you some background afterward on that. But anyway, I said to myself, "Well, now I'm going to go to these meetings in person. I'm not going to read it in the paper. I'm not going to have someone tell me. I'm going to find out exactly what goes on." So they had this meeting in the afternoon in the Great Hall of the Union, and most of the audience was white. This black fella came in on the stage with his hat on. He had bodyguards, two on each side, two in the back. So you think that the President of the United States was speaking. And he walked back and forth on the stage with his hat on, and all he did was castigate the white. Then they broke up into sort of little seminar sessions, smaller sessions. And I remember the first session that I attended, I stood there, and I believe Alicia Asman was there, who was a councilwoman now, is retired. And eventually they recognized me, and they said, "We have a regent here. I'd like to know if he has anything to say." "No," I said, "I'm here just as a spectator." So then I went to another group. And in that other group, all the people, they had people at the head table, four or five, all of them are black, including this head speaker, plus Chan Young, which you probably know. Chan Young had just been made Dean of Students, hadn't been in his office for a month. And each one was asked to give about a 2 or 3 minute statement. Well, Chan Young got up, and being pretty new in his job, was a little hesitant. Then a gal by the name of Libby, who was married to a black man named Ed. I had been with them at dinner one time before. I'd be on horror. But anyway, Ed stood at the door, and Libby got up and made 10 demands. And she wanted Chan Young to answer the 10 demands. Well, Chan Young got up and rather hesitantly did a poor job, I guess, of answering the 10 questions. And her husband stood at the door. He says, "You're not leaving this room until you answer these questions." Well, I thought, well, here I am, the regent of the university. This is one of our employees. And if I got anything, any manhood at all, I think I should get independent. So I stood up. I says, first, I knew Ed. I said, "Eddie, you have no right to not allow this man to leave this room." Then I turned to this black man, this leader, and I said, "We're in a democracy. You can burn this building down tonight. What do you accomplish?" I said, "We're here. Let's settle this by dialogue." And I made some more statements. I forgot what they were. And he got up and this guy calls me a criminal. And then as I sat down, one of those henchmen came up to me and said, "Mister, any more words out of you, we'll take care of you." He said to me. Well, Chan and I did leave the building, and we were a little bit scared. Well, the Milwaukee papers picked it up and talked about it the next day, and I mentioned at the region meeting, "Do these people here threaten you?" But I went through that. I remember also one time I talked to about 75 freshman boys at Aug Hall. And this one young man, probably 78 years old, got up and said, "Do you think you're fit to be a regent?" Well, I gave him some reasons, so I thought I was. I gave him some reasons why I thought maybe he shouldn't have been there. Got kind of put the thing back on him. But we went through that. I got lots of calls at home at first, especially.
People called you up personally?
Oh, yes. And of course, they'd harass you. I have a telephone down next to my bed. And fortunately, it's the one you can pull out the plug. They'd harass you at 2 o'clock in the morning, come up and about all this and that. And I finally got so when I went to bed, I'd pull the plug.
What kind of demands were they making of?
They'd say, "Why do you stand? Why don't you believe in this? And why don't you believe in that? Why don't you do this and that?" And then, of course, along come the dorm business, the hours. See, I was a strong stick there for rigid hours.
Well,
that
was one of the issues that came up, wasn't it?
Yeah. We had 10 o'clock visitation. And then we gave them 12 o'clock, then 2 o'clock. And then, of course, the demands were for 24-hour visitation, which they have today, you know. It's entirely different. I was with my grandson, Jeff, on Saturday. We went to the game with me. We had lunch together. They visit the girls in their room. Girls visit their boys in their room. Just nonchalant thing, I guess. Maybe they don't do any harm, but it isn't the way I was brought up.
It's a change.
It's a change. I'll have to tell you an incident that really struck me and made quite an impression upon me. The vice president of the Student Association called me, and he said, "I'd like to have to meet with you."
Do you remember his name?
I don't remember his name. "I have an interview." Well, I said, "I'm coming into the I have a bank directors meeting, and I'll be through at 10:30, and why didn't you come up to the bank? He came up to the bank at 10:30, and we had the great big directors room for ourselves. He says, why are you against 24-hour visitation? Well, I said, I'll tell you why I am. I not only feel a responsibility to the university, I feel a responsibility to your parents. Your parents send you here, they want you to have a decent place to go. I don't think that you need to have someone in your room 24 hours a day. I think if you have a convention with a young lady at 10 o'clock or 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock, which was the case at the time, that'll be sufficient. Well, he said, I don't think that you have a right to tell me how to live my life. No, I don't have a right to tell you how to live your life. But as long as you're in at the university, I am one of the governing boards of this university, and we have a right to see that you have a decent place to go to school, and that one that your parents think you've got a good place to go to. So one thing led to another. We said, well, what's wrong if I have a girl in my room 24 hours a day? Well, I says, in your estimation, there's nothing wrong. But I said, I wasn't brought up that way. Then he said, I don't believe in marriage. Well, I said, that's interesting. He said, if I want to live with a girl for 2 or 3 years and it doesn't work out, we'll break up. I can live with another one. That doesn't work out, we'll break up. Well, I said, that's rather unusual. I said, suppose you have children. What do you tell your children? I said, you say that you're going to live with this person, have children, then you're married. What do you tell them? Well, he hemmed and hawed a little bit about that. And finally, I said to him, where are you from? I'm New York City. What about your parents? Well, my parents are divorced. I said, what does your father say about this? I said, now you're living with all these girls. Well, he said that was all right. Well, then I said to him, I reversed it. I said, now what would you say if I got one of, he had sisters, if I got one of your sisters pregnant? He said, all I would say to her, if you didn't use the pill, it's your hard luck. And that really struck me. I mean, the nonchalant attitude of this young man, the sacredness of marriage or womanhood or manhood meant nothing. They were no different than the animals of our place that they mate by self-selection. Maybe the strongest shove out the weakest and so on and so forth. But since I've left, they've opened up the university to the 24-hour visitation. The girls live in the same floor with the young men, and I don't hear any adverse reports from it. There are some, I know, that it never gets out in the papers. There were some when I was there that never got in the papers.
Oh, there were?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I can remember a case, Donna, and it bothered me no end. We had a fight in the dormitories between a black boy and a white boy. And I guess the black boy started the fight, so the white boy went to the security people at the university and complained. He came back to the dormitory. The house father called him and said, why did you make a complaint? We don't want this to get out in the papers. It gives this dormitory a bad name and so on and so forth. So he called this black boy in the room and gave him a lecture and others in, and he got this boy to go down and withdraw the complaint. And this is one of the fellows that the security people, this black fellow, was one of them, they want to get something on him. And the house fellow talks him out of it. Talks the white boy to withdraw the complaint. So a lot of those things go on that they hush up.
Mm-hmm.
I know that another case that bothered me, you probably remember it, they caught, this happened to be, unfortunately, a black man, was selling dope, and I guess it was alcohol. He was a transfer student from some school in Pennsylvania. He was in trouble out there. I don't know why they took him here. And it was out in the papers that here was this man who was apprehended in Og Hall for selling heroin. My God, in one of our halls, goes out here, all our parents send these kids, they're selling dope. Well, I went right down to Madison Police Station to Bill Embry and Captain Davenport. Well, Donna, they made this raid, and this fellow had a student living with, not a student, a man living with, wasn't even a student.
In the dorm?
In the dorm, was not even a student. They raided his room, and he had what they call, cutting it, had these pieces cut. He had about $1,200 worth of dope sitting right out there in the open, and about $1,200 in money. He had more dope than that, I guess, $1,200 in money. And all the whole room was full of guns hanging on the wall, which are even prohibited in the dorm. Well, they confiscated him and arrested this fella. Now, I got this is actually, I got this right from the chief of police. And the guns had been stolen from the sports shops in Madison. So I got all this information. I went home and I thought, my God, this happens in a dormitory where we're supposed to have supervision. We're supposed to have house fellows there. So I called Smith, who was in charge of the dorms. I says, what happened here? We're supposed to have house fellows. He says, this is one of our best house fellows. I says, what happens where you have your poorest house fellows?
Good question.
Well, of course, what happened, Don, is this young man was afraid. See, this guy with the guns is afraid. Now, you see, those things that happen, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that it happens. But I'm quoting to you some of the really serious things that take place, but it does take place, and of course, our young people are a great market for this darn dope. And we've got to stop it because it wrecks many, many lives. Here it was taking place in our dormitory.
Well, as you say, a lot of this doesn't become public.
No, it was public to begin with because it wasn't the paper the guy was arrested in alcohol. But I got the details of that. Well, now we're getting away from my duties as a regent.
Yes, let's get back any more details of that first year you were regent?
Well, of course, I can remember standing up in Vice and I saw and seeing the National Guard lined up there over the hill. It was unfortunate, twice for me in the National Guard, great university, you know.
What was the reaction of the regents as a group toward the National Guard being called?
Oh, we felt we had to have the National Guard. We just felt we had to have it. Because otherwise these kids would take over the place. We just had to restore order. You can't let the darn students take over the university. And when you mention that, I give an awful lot of credit to Chancellor Ed Young, who is now President Ed Young. On the windup of the riots, the students staged a big, all through the system at that time, wanted to close down the universities and urged faculty members who were in sympathy with them, there was on the Vietnam War thing, not to attend their classes. We said any instructor, professor, or TA that does not attend a class will be deducted in pay. We said, if one student comes to class, we want you to teach that student. The chancellor at Green Bay and the chancellor at Milwaukee wanted to close. They were afraid. Ed Young at Madison says this thing stays open regardless. If they had closed down the university system, they had a big victory. Because it was remained open, that was one of the incidents that helped lessen the severity of the riots. And Ed Young gave me a lot of credit for that. And incidentally, we saved the Madison campus about $125,000 of people didn't meet their classes.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
How, I know there was a lot of talk about the possibility of closing. There was speculation at any rate.
Well,
how close a call was it?
Well, I think it's this close, Donna. As I said, the chancellor at Green Bay and Milwaukee thought that they had enough power to close, would enough people meet the classes. But we said we're not closing it. One student shows up, and we want the faculty member there. whoever he is, or she, and Ed Young put the big pressure. The big pressure was in Madison, and it kept it open.
But this was a decision by the Regents to
keep
the campuses
open. That's right, that's a decision by the Regents.
Yeah. It wasn't Harrington, and it wasn't Young.
Huh? Well, Harrington wasn't here then, was he?
Weaver came in 70.
Well, maybe,
I
maybe,
think it was before
maybe
that.
Harrington was still here. I don't forget when.
Harrington was here through 69.
Yeah.
It's close, but
it's close, right?
I think the worst of it was over when Weaver came.
Yeah, oh yes. Yeah, I think that was over when he came, but that remained over. And of course, I think down to the incident, the one incident in the country as a whole that put the damper on the rioting was the da-bombing of
Sterling Hall.
Because after that, things all over the nation subsided, and they took the life of that fine young man with his two youngsters and destroyed all that research and that. That was.
You really feel that this was instrumental?
I think that was a catalyst that started right there. I think it was. And I must relate to you a little about that. Of course, in the morning it was news and the radio and television. And immediately I went over. And of course, at that time everything was already fenced off with snow fence and a lot of men working in there. Went up to Bascom Hall, and Ed Young was chancellor. Ed says, "Come on, I'm going down there. Go in there with me." And because of that visit, Donna, I have tremendous respect for the FBI. Here were 40 or 50 men working in overalls and hard hats. I thought they were workers cleaning up the debris. They were the FBI. They'd pick up a little piece as big as your fingernail, and they put together that van that was blown to smithereens. That thing was loaded with dynamite all over that whole area. They put together, that was the evidence that they got on those brothers.
Armstrong
boys. That was the evidence because they owned that van and face down where they got the dynamite up there at Badger Orton's. So there was the people that put that together. And I can't help, there's a lot of condemnation of the FBI, but they rate pretty high with me because of that one incident. They're meticulous, they don't give up. And isn't it surprising that one of these people is still at large, have been caught?
Yes, I guess that is.
They've got three of them, and one is still at large. And another thing that surprised me, they come back in the sympathy some of these fellows get. These students turn out. Here they destroyed all that property, all that research. I guess they destroyed 15 years of research for physics people.
Oh yes, they were very,
very hard hit. And it cost the taxpayers of the state, I guess, $6 or $7 million to restore everything.
Well, I think
took a life.
Yeah, it was the mood of the times.
The person that they were after, I know very well, was Barclay Rossrup, who was the head of the mathematical research. Was he ever received one of the threats? That's his work that they're after. Of course, he's now is retired from that.
Well, then I don't know whether it happened while you were still regent, but the decision was made to move the mathematics research center.
Yeah, that was I was still regent. They're now out in the Wharf Building.
Yes.
Yes.
Do you think this was a good move?
Well, I don't know. It was moved out there because of the. Of the bombing or not, I think it was just a matter of space. Mm-hmm. They needed the space here, and Wharf had the space out there. I don't think it was any move to just get them out.
I don't think it was politically motivated.
I don't think so. That's my thinking.
Well, one wonders.
Well, of course, they're out there now, and sure, they did more work for the military, and they did a lot of other work. Now, this doctor. Head of the mathematical research. He goes all over the world. He spent the summer in England this year teaching mathematics, advanced mathematics. He's recognized the world over. Barclay Rossrup.
Rossrup, yes.
Yes, as a world famous mathematician. I know he and his wife very well. So those are things that have taken place. Another thing that took place in my term is we made the original appropriation for the medical school.
You did that?
Oh yes, which is been a controversial thing ever since. And
well, I'd like you to talk about that a bit.
Yeah.
Because this is, as you say, it has been ever since, and it still is.
Let me say this. The governor Knowles appointed a Blue Ribbon Study Committee, and it was headed by Don Slichter, who was retired president of Northwestern Mutual, you know, the famous Slichter family. At the time, they recommended three medical schools, one at Milwaukee, University of Milwaukee, one at Marquette, and one at Madison. Of course, the first one was to be, Madison one was to be enlarged, hopefully that later on they could come out with another one at Milwaukee and Marquette. Well, in the meantime, of course, Marquette got into financial difficulty, and they had to divest themselves of the school in order to get state money, because they were a private institution. Now it's the Wisconsin Medical School, and they've gotten state money. And they appointed Dave Carley president, and Dave was the regent for a while, it was me. And Dave Carley did a remarkable job in raising money. I believe he raised almost $70 million of outside money for that school. In fact, I was with a meeting I was with a week ago, with the president, McNair, of Wisconsin Electric Power. He said, well, he hit us good and hard. He said he's hit the Milwaukee area so hard that it's hurt like the United Givers Drive, you know. These corporations gave so much. Well, of course, so we've got a good, viable school now in Marquette. We originally appropriated, I believe it was $80 million. It was supposed to be $140 million for the school. That was the first recommendation. But the state would not go along with that, and we cut that down to $80 million. Well, that got underway. And then, of course, they were going to, Donna, with the combination of the Veterans Hospital, would have quite an institution of about 1,000 beds. Well, I can't understand, this has happened now since my time, I can't understand that these administrators, they did not have an agreement in writing with the federal people about those two hospitals being connected.
And something went wrong.
Something went wrong. They had nothing done about a verbal agreement, and you can't have verbal agreements when you start talking millions of dollars. That's where all this controversy has come about. Well, I guess they've got it settled now. But now, of course, the school with all their, then they made some changes, and I can't understand this. They had doors that the hospital beds didn't go through. Well, I jumped some of these. I jumped some of these administrators. That says, well, they've changed the size of the hospital beds. Now they're larger. Now whether that's the case or not, I don't know. But they had to remodel doors and things like that. Now this school, this medical facility, instead of costing $80 million, is going to cost $100 million. Now they've just appropriated another $4 or $5 million to the State Building Commission for. What is it, a diagnostic center or something in addition?
Something like that, yes.
So it is certainly going to be a great facility when it's finished, but it's going to be very expensive. Now, the medical school itself, Donna, has been a controversial school for some reason or other at that university. When my brother was a regent, it was during the Dr. Bauer era, they brought him in. Dr. Middleton resigned, retired. But Dr. Middleton was a tremendous man. He run that medical school with an iron hand, and when Dr. Middleton ran it, it was run. But the minute he was out, he had the factions, and they brought in Dr. Bauer. Well, they claim, this is what you hear, that it was that continually bickering and controversy at that medical school that killed Dr. Elvium. Dr. Elvium could not leave his problems in the office when he went home. He took them home with him. He worried. And you hear that it helped bring on his early demise.
I've heard it helped bring on his demise, yeah. So I haven't heard anybody's point the finger, particularly at the medical school.
That's what, my brother went through all that. He went through bringing Bauer. Well, Bauer was brought here for a mission. Bauer was brought to bring Tranquility to that medical school, and I guess he did a pretty good job, but then he got fired because of that. Well, then they had so many factions out there, between the diagnosticians, and then they had the surgeons and whatnot that couldn't agree. Well, during my term, we brought in Dr. Cook, who has since left, and Dr. Crowley, who has now left, to go to Stanford. Back, we brought him from Stanford.
Now, why is this?
I'm going to get to that.
I won't rush you then.
Dr. Cook, to me, was quite impressive. But for some reason or other, Dr. Cook did not go over with the people here at the school. And besides that, he had developed domestic troubles. He divorced his wife and married a secretary and this and that, and he's left and gone back east. But Dr. Crowley was tremendously respected. Everybody you talk to, and I talk to these people very often, I meet them socially, but they're sorry to see him leave. Well, one of the reasons that Dr. Crowley left, Dr. Crowley came from California, and his wife had polio when she was younger, and a very lovely woman, and still shows some of the effect in these cold winters, especially when we had last winter, did not set very well with her, and she wanted to get back to a warmer climate. That was one of the reasons he left. And of course, he's an outstanding man, and Stanford wanted him back. So he's back where he came from. Now they're right, they have nobody. And they're bringing in the new chancellor.
Shane.
I think that Shane's a very an outstanding man. He was assistant chancellor when I was on the board, and he left to go out to Seattle at the University of Washington, and he left for, I think, a couple of reasons. One was that, of course, he came, his family was raised out in the West. And number two, he and, what's this gal's name?
Serena Ponder.
Did not get along. She was shoved way up there at the vice presidency.
Do you know anything about how she?
Well, all I can quote is your hearsay. And this probably won't be published for some time, but she was kind of Ed Young's pet. I don't know why he brought her up there. One of the top administrators, and Ed always thought she was quite a gal, brought her up there. But she and Shane did not hitch, and Shane hated her, and she hated Shane. So Irv Shane went out to Seattle, and Martha and I were just out to Seattle. More part of October, we had dinner with Irv Shane and his wife.
Oh,
of course, yeah, talked a lot about his coming back. And of course, the laughable part of it is that this happened before we went out, and the first move that Shane did, he demoted Serena Pondrum.
I saw, noticed in the paper that office was going to be phased out.
He just phased out the office. But she has seniority, she can go back to teach English, but he took care of that immediately.
Did he talk about this situation at all when you were out there?
Yes, we talked about it. And I wouldn't want that to be released right now, because certainly this is confidential, but I understand this is confidential.
Exactly.
We talked about that, and talked about his coming back. And I am pleased that he received the appointment, because, number one, he was vice chancellor. And he worked a lot with that medical school. And that medical school right now is his big, right now he's got no dean and he's got no vice president of medical affairs. He's got nobody out there. He's got just somebody acting. So he knows the situation out there. That's how it was brought up. I have tremendous respect for Irv Shane, Donna. He's a hard worker. He is a hard worker. He will work 24 hours a day if he has to get the job completed. And he's a nice family, and he's not a showman. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't go out and pick him out in the crowd. Here's a showman who does a lot of talking, but I think that he's an excellent choice for to head this university. And this is the prime university of the system right here at Madison. That choice, I think, is good.
Well, there seemed to be a lot of enthusiasm when it became known.
And he says,
coming back.
He says to me, he says, I will get that medical school situation straightened out, and I think he will. He isn't jumping in cold. He had it before he left. So I'm optimistic.
Well, I wonder, did the fact that he was familiar with this situation among others, do you think influenced the choice of him?
I think yes. I think the fact that he had worked under Ed Young, and I'm sure Ed Young gave him a high recommendation, and a number of these regents knew Irv Shane's work while he was still here, knew what he did. Now see, Irv Shane was here for 24 years, Donna. He was the chairman of the chemistry department before he took that administrative job. And he's not a newcomer to the University of Wisconsin campus. And the laughable part of this, the first meeting he had with the faculty, this faculty member jumped him right away, initiated him good to...
Was this Beck?
Yeah,
Anatole Beck.
Anatole Beck. And I know Anatole real well. He's a likable guy. He's a very radical fella. But he jumped him right away about the faculty governance. And I thought Irv handled it well. But that was his initiation, his first meeting with the faculty.
Were you at this meeting?
No, I read this. It was interesting to me because I know all the participants. See. Mm-hmm. Well, now we've gotten away again from an instance that happened during the time I was a regent. Some of them have happened since. We've talked about the medical school. I think this now, that if they get this medical school once going, it'll be a great thing because we can now turn out about 200 doctors a year, take 200 students. And we are so short of good medical practitioners, particularly in this state, in the smaller communities. Everybody wants now to be a specialist. They want to go to the big cities and be a bone specialist or heart specialist. But to get out in these smaller communities. And you see about half of your medical graduates, or 45%, never stay in the state. They leave. You can't say, well, you got to stay here. You can urge them to stay. And surprisingly, the majority go to California. Climate, higher fees. In fact, I'm the president of the Wisconsin Rural Rehabilitation Corporation, and we're very interested in this, and we are financing 50 what they call externships each summer, where these first-year medical students go out to the smaller communities like Sun Prairie, Viroqua, Soldiers Grove, Wanakee, Toma, any of these small places to live and work with this doctor for the summer, hoping that they will become interested in family practice and go to these smaller communities. And we think it's worked out very well so far. And we also are giving to Dr. I think it's Romer, or he has young doctors go out to these areas and spend 2 months in the summertime hoping that they'll be going to family practice. The other thing I'm very concerned about now, and I'm very disappointed that it hasn't taken place, that we've got this great medical school and we don't have a veterinary school.
Well, yes. Now that keeps popping up.
All right. The regents, while I was on the board, approved a medical school. A veterinary school, I beg your pardon. And, of course, it never got off the ground. There's some history back of that. First of all, when they had the... state coordinating committee that was supposed to coordinate at that time the state colleges there worked with the university system.
Yeah, the CCHC.
Yeah. I know that I appeared before that board, and, of course, at that time, River Falls wanted a veterinary school. We wanted Wisconsin. And we couldn't agree, and finally they said to us, well, you people can't agree on where you want the veterinary school, forget about it. What we should have been doing at that time is to have been organized. We would have had a veterinary school, and we were fighting among ourselves.
That explains part of the answer, because people right. keep saying, how is it that an agricultural state like Wisconsin does not have
that
a veterinary school?
That is an excellent question. That's an excellent question, Donna, because every state around us has a veterinary school. Take Ohio, Illinois, Iowa, Michigan, even Ontario. Kansas all have veterinary schools. And we have the third largest cattle population in the nation. And we don't have a veterinary school. Well, they said you can send them to Minnesota. We got an agreement. All right. Minnesota takes 17 students each year. And I understand this year half of them are girls, and they're going to mostly go into pet practice. And the trouble with the agreement, these reciprocal agreements, is this. If I were a taxpayer in the state of Minnesota, and my son or daughter were refused admission to the veterinary school, and some youngster from Wisconsin that didn't have any better grades, I would raise Ned. I would say, all right, why isn't my youngster taken in here? I support this institution. Well, of course, first, the University of Minnesota wanted us to put some money into buildings up in St. Paul, Minneapolis. Well, what a ridiculous thing that would be, to put money up there and then something happens, and here said our buildings was Wisconsin money in. Well, then they had this reciprocal agreement. I guess we don't get any other schools, but anyway, it got down to now, Donna, where this last session of legislature approved the medical school, everybody approved it, went to the governor's office, they vetoed it. Now I notice that...
Well, do you know why?
He revealed because of money. He said, take money. Don't take it right now, about $30, $40 million. But, you see, the medical people want it out here, because a lot of the research now for medical school is right in cooperation with the veterinary school. They're working the same animals, the same thing. Some of them take some of the same courses. So there, I know Dr. Cook was strong for it when he was here. And now I see that that Dave, what's his last name, running for governor?
Carly?
Carly, in an interview up here at Eau Claire with a question, he said, if I had been governor, I would have signed the bill for the veterinary school. And Roy Kopp, former president of Regents, and I are going to meet with Schreiber when he gets back. Cop's gone now, and they're going to get his feeling on the veterinary school. We think we can still get the support of the legislature to have a veterinary school. Now it'll have to be supported. You can't go out and just say we're going to tax you $10. I think we probably have to put a tax on pet foods or something like that to get the money.
But you think there's a chance that it will go through?
I think I'm very pleased that Carly mentioned, and then he almost puts Schreiber in the seat that he has to say, I also support him at next school. I don't know how he can say he will not.
That's an interesting development, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting development, and we're working on that. If the University of Wisconsin could have a veterinary school, with what it has now, I would see it would be one of the great agricultural universities in the world. That's what it lacks. It's got everything else. We have, Donna, we have the pre-vet and the post-vet, but we can't turn out a registered veterinarian. Isn't that ridiculous?
Well, yes, it does seem
ridiculous. And I blame myself. I should have been working much stronger years ago on this thing, because then it wasn't so much a question of money. Money wasn't as tight as it is now, all these appropriations, welfare and whatnot. And we should have had a veterinary school and had it going. Because it's more difficult to get into a veterinary school today than it is to get into a medical school. Do you realize that?
No, I didn't.
It is. It's more difficult. I just can't get in.
So there isn't any argument that the need isn't there.
Oh, there's no argument about the need. Well, you hear some of the opponents say, well, I know that this representative from Milwaukee was conducting hearings as well. Most have gotten there. they practice with pets, dogs, cats, well, have you? Well, sure they do. And people have these pets, and they want service, so what? A lot of doctors took look after kids that aren't very sick either. They have eczema and stuff that they could take care of at home. But we got this terrific pet population. And another big thing is that need for veterinarians in our inspection of meat. I believe I read Oscar Mayer's report recently. I believe they have 40 veterinarians that are meat inspectors right in this Madison plant.
Now, I didn't realize that this was a function of veterinarians.
Oh, yes. The veterinarians are your meat inspectors. They are your meat inspectors. And the health of the animals. A few years ago, the mink people had something got in their mink. Almost destroyed the business. The veterinarians come in and say that. I remember years ago, we used to feed a lot of lambs. And we bought some lambs in Kansas City in the market. They came out of Colorado. They came in beautiful, 1,800 of them. And we've got them in the summertime. You shear them because it's too warm. And they begin to die. They had a bloody dysentery. They died, and we thought we knew everything how to handle these animals. We got the state veterinarian, and he was baffled. And finally, called Swift and Company, and they sent up their veterinarian, and he diagnosed that coccidiosis, the disease of poultry. They picked it up someplace. Hmm. And the treatment for that is milk. You get milk and it gets lactic acid, and we have drench each animal, catch them, and drench them. Well, their veterinary stopped our loss. Of course, we lost half of them. But those are the things that they important part they play in our daily lives. And we have kept, Donna, we have kept foot and mouth disease out of this nation, which is one of the most devastating diseases that can get into livestock. Because if you ever get it, suppose you got into our deer herds, our antelope herds, but how would you cure it? How would you control it? And we've kept it out through our careful quarantine of animals coming in, sanitation through our veterinary department, state department, national department of agriculture. So they are very important, and very important in your food. It isn't only the veterinary's job, or a trained veterinarian doesn't only work with animals. He has so much to do with the food that you eat. There are a lot of ramifications of what they can do. So we're working on it. I'm a little bit optimistic, because when Carly came out and said he would not have vetoed the veterinary school, it almost put Shriver on the stump to say he has to do the same thing, or else he's going to lose a lot of farm food.
Well, I guess you'll think of this. I'm encouraged, because I've, I guess, privately been plugging for it.
Yeah. And you have to have a medical school in connection with a veterinary school. And another thing we had to do, to satisfy the people from River Falls, we're going to have a little sort of a satellite veterinary school there. They'll have some animals there, they'll do some research, and they can train some pre-vets and then come down here. So we had to, that was a political move, to because we couldn't have them being anti against us, because see, they're pretty close to Minnesota. Much closer to Minnesota than they are here. So to get them to work with us, that's going to be sort of a little satellite veterinary school.
This is in the plan?
That's in the plan, oh yeah. That's where the plan that was passed in the legislature.
I haven't gone into details on that.
That's it. Well, where were we at?
Well, I think we're...
I saw Henry here while I'm going. This
is Henry Pito.
Yeah, he's a fine young doctor, and well, he's not young, but he's not old. But he was made head of McCardle, which is one of the great research centers in the world. And I talked to him, and he was glad to get out of that deanship. That's a hornet's nest, deanship out there. This was.
Well, I recall that it was a problem. He's a central figure.
Dr. Mendelson was a most remarkable man. Of course, he's the man that really made the the medical school at Wisconsin. And you hear so many different things about the man, because he just recently was deceased. But one of the things I remember very vividly, that was about 3 years ago, when, I stopped that a minute, I get my name, when Dr. Gordon, who was a famous heart man, lost his life skiing out in the West. And they had a memorial service for Dr. Gordon after they found the body. And Dr. Weaver and I went, at that time President Weaver, to this memorial service. And Dr. Middleton gave the eulogy. I think at that time he must have been 85 years of age. He stood up there and talked for 15 minutes. He related dates like June 15, 1945, or dates like that, marriage, whatnot, of Ed Gordon and Lola Gordon's marriage and life. I sat there in awe of that man at that age, the good applicant could do that at that age. He had that faculty. I heard him one time, a few years previous to that, give a half hour talk at Rotary. For 1.5 hour without a note. He was way over 80. Excellent speech. And I had a little surgery this last spring in May 1977. And some of the doctors there had their training under Dr. Middleton. And we got talking about Dr. Middleton. This one man said, when we went around with Dr. Middleton in the morning to make the calls, you wouldn't dare look at the person's chart. You would have to know that case and be able to stand and give the details to Dr. Middleton without looking at the chart. He was that demanding. And even at his advanced age, he was at that hospital at 7 o'clock in the morning, making the rounds of his patients. He was that kind of an individual. A most remarkable man, and no matter who you talk to, the medical profession has nothing but the highest praise for that doctor, Middleton.